Excuse me, sir. My wife just reminds me when did we meet and where. Yeah? I forgot exactly where we were meeting. Now, what I want to do is, I've been teaching in various departments.
Mr. Stanley?
Yes, sir.
You pursued the law last week with some absolute discussion about me.
You?
Yeah, to the magistrate. So, Keith, I'm not talking to you.
Okay, you don't want to talk to me, I'll report it if you don't want to talk to me. Who shall I speak to you? I can secure that?
No, there's nobody else. You don't need to speak to other
people. Who's your senior or your junior that I can sort of discuss? You see, if I get
to starting with the same thing.
All I want to do is just when I make proposals, it is not to be acknowledged.
By your department. By whose department?
Your department. Science and technology. Do you know who I should address? Okay, you just direct me to whom I should direct my mail. I want to present a different solution than diesel.
Send it to the Department of Energy.
They don't even acknowledge the receipt of your insurance. Science and technology can confirm the science. Yeah.
And take it to one of the universities where the great professor Vickers from here, then what you know.
The most direct one should be the government. You know, they got a war office. Now, how shall I get to the war office?
You won't get to the war office. You've got a history behind you. You've really messed up the church several times.
No, I'll tell you what.
Several times.
I'll tell you what, you know. I need to present something to the government. I want to offer the methanol instead of diesel for the generators. We handle them.
I'm going to go to the next one. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this meeting.
Good morning, by Smith, member of the committee and presenting Lumbopo.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. My name is Thomas Ohaya. I'm Deputy Director General in the Department of Science and Technology. I'm here to represent the Department and the Minister, Minister Pando of Central Ecology, in Brazil at the moment for a BRICS meeting that she couldn't possibly postpone. And the Director General, Dr. Ndraka, is in Geneva also for meetings that he couldn't postpone. So they both send their regret and their apologies, and I'm here to represent them. Thank you. I'll ask those to my team as the producer as well.
Good morning. My name is Egeha Teres. I'm the Director for Higher Health.
Good morning, members. My name is Dennis Stein. I'm the Director of Science and Ben.
Good morning, members. My name is Leon Dakran, the Economic Affairs Officer of the Ministry.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Andy Patenda, the Office of the Director General.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I am Martin McCahey. I am Special Advisor to the Minister of Canada.
Thank you very much. Over to the officer.
My name is Lori Sibir. I am the Committee Secretary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair and honourable members. We were asked by the committee to come brief you on our human capital development initiative, both in general and also to give insight into specific human capital development initiatives linked to specific industrial sectors. So there was interest in the committee also in this respect. So the presentation then will cover these aspects here. First of all, we would like to position our human capital development initiatives in the overall institutional context, then give you an insight into the policy framework within which we are doing our work, introduce you to some of the systemic challenges around human capital development, and the programs that the department has initiated in response to those challenges, and then to present to you some sector-specific human capital interventions, just to give you examples of the specific skills development interventions that we're making in some sectors. Then I'd also like to talk to you a bit about our science promotion and engagement activities that have to do with popularizing science and technology at schools level within the general public, because this is part of a human capital development chain. And then lastly, just some concluding observations. So first of all, honorable members and chair, just the institutional landscape. It's very important to remember that there are at least three different national departments, one of them with provincial competence, that are involved in human capital development, and they all have distinct mandates and different institutional platforms and different budgets to deal with their respective roles and responsibilities. So the Department of Basic Education, as you know, is responsible for basic education. Its budget is over 200 billion rand, which includes the provincial budget. There are some 26,000 schools in the system and 12 million learners. Just to give the context of the responsibility of the Department of Basic Education, the Department of Higher Education and Training, which is responsible for higher education, has a budget of over 30 billion rand for universities. There are now 25 universities and close on a million students. And a national student financial aid scheme is 6 billion, more than 6 billion rand, latest salary was 9 billion rand, I think. So it's really large. Now, the context, therefore, the Department of Science and Technology is responsible for research, development, and support. We're not responsible for universities or for university training in that sense. So we're responsible for research, development, and support, and innovation across the national system of innovation. Our budget is 6.5 billion. We reach through our science engagement and science promotion activities around 720,000 school learners out of the 12 million. But we reach them only for a few hours in the year, a few days in the year, not throughout the year. And then lastly, we support some 10,000 students through our bursary schemes. So this is just to create the context and give you a sense of, honorable members, the scale of the department's ability to intervene in the system. Turning now to the national policy framework. First of all, at highest level, the National Development Plan has set specific targets for the country in the area of science and technology and university education. So it has, for example, said that by 2030 we need to produce more than 100 doctoral graduates or PhD graduates per million of the population, and within that we need to increase significantly the number of Africans and women. We're currently producing about 36 or 38 doctoral graduates per million of population in 1 year. So it's a trebling of the current output that we have to achieve by 20, or should try and achieve by 2030. Between now and then, we should be producing an additional 100,000 PhDs per year. We're currently producing about 2,000 per year. So the 100,000 that we have to produce, the additional 100,000, you can work out that at the current rate, that would take us 50 years. So we have to significantly ramp up the way in which we're producing them. We should see by 2030, we should have at least 75% of our university academics with doctoral degrees, because technically a doctoral degree is the certificate that you're allowed to train doctoral students. You know, it's like, you know, a person doesn't have a university degree teaching at university or teaching school. That is, you know, you need at least something higher than the people you're teaching. So currently we're at about 37 or 38%. Of all academic staff with PhD. So again, it's 2.5 times that we have to increase the number by. And then the National Development Plan also acknowledges the importance of hosting science expositions and interventions about popularizing science among young people. It talks to that as well. Then at the level below the National Development Plan, there is of course the medium-term strategic framework, which really sets out the first 5 years of the National Development Plan. And the in terms of EDIP terms, the framework, there's a specific outcome, number 5, which is called a skilled and capable workforce to support an inclusive growth path. The department's human capital development initiative specifically addressed this outcome in the NTSF. There are a number of outputs that we generate in support of that. At the departmental level, the policy framework is formulated by two key high-level documents. The one is a National Research and Development Strategy, which was published in 2002. It makes provisions for human capital development as a priority for the department. It also highlights the need to invest in scientific knowledge infrastructure. You cannot train research students, postgraduate students, if you don't have research equipment and infrastructure in the university. So it's important to focus on that too. It highlights the importance of knowledge generation, because our postgraduate students, particular doctoral students, are very important elements in the production of knowledge at the university. It's not just the established researchers of the university academics. It's the students who do this under their guidance, but they're an important ingredient in knowledge generation. The strategic management of the public science and technology system, and then it also introduced the notion of centers and networks of excellence. I'll talk more to that later on. Then the second key document is a 10-year innovation plan, which re-emphasizes, and that was published in 2007, and that re-emphasizes the importance of human capital development. And then lastly, in the last financial year, the minister approved a departmental human capital development strategy for research, innovation, and scholarship. So these are the policy documents within which the department operates. Now, just some insights into the systemic challenges around human capital development. The first I've already alluded to, the supervisory capacity to improve postgraduate completion rates is a challenge. We don't have enough supervisors in the university to increase the number of PhD students that are enrolled in the dramatic way in which they need to be increased, given our development ambitions, with 38% of staff currently having PhDs. So roughly only one-third of our academic staff are actually competent to supervise doctoral students. So this is a challenge. The second challenge is the low bursary values. I'll be providing more information on that shortly. We have enough money to support a certain number of students at a certain level. Obviously, we can increase the number of students we support if we reduce the amount each student gets, or we can increase the amount each student gets by reducing the number of students. So balancing that equation is difficult. And the outcome of all is that we really can't support enough students at the appropriate level. And that does result in lower progression ratios. So there's fewer students who move from a bachelor's degree to an honors degree to a master's to a doctoral degree than we need and we want. Then there are also poor demographic representation within the established researcher level. So these are researchers that are professors, senior professors who've been academics for, you know, at least 20 years or so. Given that, there are still serious demographic challenges amongst the established researchers that we have to deal with too. And then lastly, we have a fairly small science system. Our scientists are very productive. We have good statistics that show that scientists and scientists who are actively involved in research are very productive at a global level. But our system is very, very small. We only have 25 or so full-time equivalent researchers in our national system, 25,000 full-time equivalent researchers. So our system is quite small in terms of our global ambitions. Just talking a little bit more about the systemic challenges, I refer to the low progression ratio and what we now call the demographic drop-off. So in the top row on this slide, you'll see the number of students enrolled in 2012 for undergraduate or bachelor's degrees, for honors degrees, for master's and for doctoral degrees. So the number of students enrolled at undergraduate bachelor level was 750,000, at honors level 85,000, master's level just short of 50,000, and doctoral level I think 14,000. The numbers are a bit higher now, but the pattern that I'm going to illustrate is the same. The second row indicates the number of graduates at those different levels, and the third and fourth rows indicate the percentage of black students enrolled at those levels and the number of women students enrolled at those levels. And what you can see is that the number of the statistics decrease negatively as you move from an undergraduate to an honors to a master's and a PhD level. So the demographic representation of our doctoral students is still only 60% black, and that's just simply not sustainable. You'll see that similarly there's a demographic drop-off with a number of women students at the undergraduate level to PhD level. So this is an important challenge, and we're beginning to get evidence that this is linked strongly to the extent of or the lack of sufficient state support. Just to provide a little bit more detail on this, there are high attrition rates. So there was a study made of a 2001 PhD cohort of all the students enrolled at a particular university in 2001 for a PhD. 10 years later, or 12 years later, I can't remember the exact, but it was 10 years later, 46% of those students had never completed their degree. Now, a PhD should take 4 or 5 years, maybe 6 at the most. 10 years later, 46% had not completed the degree. 29% had dropped out in the first 2 years, and 36% had dropped out in the natural sciences, whereas 53% had dropped out in the humanities. So there's high attrition rates. Students who enroll for PhDs don't manage to complete their PhD studies. And we think that this is strongly linked to the level of advisory values that we provide. So in 2013-14, these were the average levels that we were able to afford to invest in an honors student, a master's, and a doctoral student, and a postdoctoral student. And these are the sort of after-tax salaries that students in those categories would be able to earn. So the question is whether they can afford to enroll for a PhD, for a postgraduate degree or not, by comparison to what they would be able to earn. And if you accept that most of our university graduates at undergraduate level are first-generation graduates from poor backgrounds, there are expectations of their families that they cannot meet with the 40,000 rand bursary, but they might be able to meet a little bit better with the 100,000 rand after-tax salary as a bachelor's graduate. So these are the hard choices that our students are faced with. Further systemic challenges is something which was just recently identified with the Golden Planet Majority. It turns out that within the university, within the 35 universities, there are about 12,000 permanent academic staff members at a lecturer and senior lecturer level. Of those 12,000, roughly half are black, 2,500 are black women. Now, we only, through the National Research Foundation, support around 650 what we call emerging researchers. Emerging researchers are the ones that would normally be sitting in this band of lecturer and senior lecturer. So you've got there 12,000 academic staff, of whom only about 650 are receiving research grants. And maybe 1,000 of those 12,000 are applying for research grants. So you have a huge majority of academic staff sitting at lecturer and senior lecturer level, who somehow do not see themselves as researchers, even though they're sitting in university. And we've called this a silent majority. We're only now starting to investigate, or start a project of investigating, why is it that within the university we've got these large numbers of academic staff who don't even try to get research grants. So I can't answer this question yet, but we've identified the challenge. Only fairly recently, and then as I said, we support about 650 emerging researchers in this category only, of which 140 are black women, out to 2,500 who potentially could be applied for grants getting research grants. Alright, these HDD programs of the department, just to outline to you that our human capital development conceptual framework, we have identified three categories of researchers that we support. The one is what we call, the mouse is not showing there, sorry. I thought the mouse was projected on the screen there as well. So on the left hand block, the next generation researchers, this is basically the postgraduate students that we support and the postdoctoral fellows. So that's the one category of researchers. The next one is what we call the emerging researchers. These are people who have recently obtained a PhD and are now beginning to establish themselves as researchers and academics in our research institutions and our universities. And then on the extreme right-hand side, the last category is what we call the established researchers. These are largely at universities, but there might be some that are in the private research council, like the Medical Research Council, or MINTEC, or something like that as well. These are people who would typically be, at least 10 or 15 years into a research career,
but the average is probably about 20 to 25 years that you're restricted. So within those three different categories, we've established a number of different programs. So on the left-hand side, the main sort of program that we have to support next-generation researchers are our postgraduate bursaries. Most of our money there gets invested in postgraduate bursary support to undergraduate students, and we have some internship or workplace readiness programs as well that I'll talk to a little bit later. In the emerging researchers category, we have a postdoctoral fellowship. These are in a sense, bursaries to people who have got PhDs, but are not yet academic staff members. So they're at that sort of interim, like an apprentice academic, as it were, and we provide them with bursaries as well. There are about 500 that we support, 450, 500, something like that, that we support. And then we have a number of different programs to support emerging researchers. One of them is called Tutuka. And then on the established researchers, our two main programs, well, they're really three, although I've mentioned two here. The South African Research Chairs Initiative, SARCHI, the South African Research Chairs. That's 156 posts that we have established in the universities of senior researchers dedicated to undertake research, and our Centre of Excellence program. So these are the key interventions in these three categories. Just to look quickly now at these three different categories, at the emerging researchers, our postgraduate students that we support, this just shows you the level of support for honors, masters, doctoral and postdoctoral students and fellows. And you'll see that although over the period from 2008 to 2013-14, it's been quite a significant growth in all these categories. For the last few years, it's been fairly flat. We will be, in the next financial year, be able to increase this quite a lot because we've got a big injection from Treasury that becomes active in the 2015-16 financial year. So we've got 400 million new rands of new money. So we'll be able to have another big jump in this, like you'll see in some of the there was a big spike from between 2009-10 and 2010-11. There was a big jump in most of these years. We'll be able to see such a jump again at the end of the next financial year. This here indicates to you the percentage of the total numbers of students enrolled at the honors, masters, doctoral level that we have been able to support with our funding. Now, it's important for me to mention that the National Student Financial Aid Scheme is almost explicitly focused on undergraduate students. It only supports students in their first degree. The Department of Science and Technology Bursary Program is the largest state support program for postgraduate students. And yet, you'll see that at the honors level, just looking at 2013, we're only able to support 5% of all enrolled honors students, 7% of all enrolled master's students, and 14% of all enrolled PhD students. That's the limit of the capacity, the limit of financial capacity that we've got. So on average, we support 7% of postgraduate students. And this is a big challenge because NSFAS supports around 22-23% of undergraduate students. But state support for postgraduate students drops them from over 20 to under 10. And this big gap, we think, accounts for a large part of why there's this drop in students that can't afford to continue doing postgraduate studies. The numbers of students, you'll see, have been increasing nicely over the years, but not nearly at the rate we need to in terms of the National Development Plan ambition. And then at the bottom, you'll see the amounts that have been invested. So, you know, next year we'll be investing around 700 million, 750 million. So it's a significant increase. And Treasury has understood the importance of this, as you can see from the increase of funding. This year, I won't dwell on this. The members will be able to look at this in their own good time. But this year presents to the demographics of the students that we supported at the different levels. And although you can see that from 2008 to 2013-14, there have been good increases from between 30 and 40% of blacks and women, roughly, to sort of between around about 50 to 70%. But you can still see that these are not nearly representative, these demographics. So again, this is an unsustainable situation. If we're going to grow our science system going into the future, it has to draw on South Africa's population at large, can't draw on a minority. So there really is a strategic imperative for us to be improving this. There have been improvements, but we need to drive this more strongly forward. So just some concluding comments on the postgraduate students. Over the last 5 years, the government has supported at least 34,000 postgraduate students, more than doubling the financial investment from 200 million to 540, and as I indicated, it will be 750 million in the next financial year. In terms of black representation, improvements have been made, but it's stagnated a little recently, and the improvements have not been good enough. So we need to continue driving that. In terms of women, however, the targeted proportional representation that we've set targets for, it's fairly close to that. We're doing quite well in terms of gender demographics amongst the postgraduate students. Turning now to that second block of researchers, the emerging researchers. These are the ones who have got PhDs and are now busy preparing themselves for research and academic careers. The first is our postdoctoral support program, where we spend about 100 million rand essentially in postgraduate in fellowships for postdoctoral researchers. These fellowships would be anywhere between 150 and 300,000 rand per annum. The average is about 180 or so. It's not yet competitive, but the backlog there is not quite as big as it is for the PhD students, for the masters and the honors students. Then there is the TUCA program, which is specifically focused at black and women emerging researchers, in which we invest around 50 million rand. Then we have some competitive funding for unrated researchers at around 20 million rand a year. And then research career advancement fellowship. This is a program which we've established in partnership with the universities, where we support the researchers for a period of 4, 5, or 6 years, and the universities then try to absorb them onto their staff at the end of that period. This is, I've already indicated the number of grants. We support around 650 emerging researchers per year, and you can see that over the years, although the number has unfortunately remained fairly stagnant, the per capita level of support that they have received, this is now not bursary money, because these are employed staff members at universities or research councils. So these are grants that they get to run a research activity. So for research consumable expenses, and there will be in here also bursaries, a limited number of bursaries for students that are going to work with these researchers. So the per capita amount has increased, but we haven't been able to increase the number of people receiving grants. So, with regard to emerging researchers, just some concluding comments. While significant investments were made in this category by the DSC, it's not led to significant growth in the numbers of supported researchers, but mainly in the growth of the average grant. So we need to turn that situation around, and we've initiated discussions with the Department of Higher Education and Training, who has to be a partner in turning this situation around, because really they have the ability to influence the 12,000 academics sitting in this group that we have no leverage over. The Department of Education Training with the universities has leverage in this regard. Secondly, significant minority of early career academics remain dormant with respect to research, which is the problem I've referred to. In terms of equity, growth have been made in the portion of white women. So from a gender perspective, that's been good. But the representation of black and black women has fluctuated and remained fairly stagnant over the last 4 or 5 years. So again, it remains a challenge for us. And we need to continue monitoring the performance of these programs, particularly with respect to their transformation. Turning now to established researchers, I need to ask you to ignore this slide because there are mistakes on the slide. I will make the point of the slide with reference to this second slide here. So we're now turning to the last block, the established researchers, the people who have been researchers for at least 10, 15 years. And this presents to you the statistics of the established researchers that are supported by the National Research Foundation. The National Research Foundation is our key agency for investment of research grants. And you'll see that if you look at the bar chart there, the statistics have been moving. From year to year. So there's been good increases in the number of black and women grant holders and rated researchers. Rated researchers are researchers, established researchers who have undergone a rating by the National Research Foundation. So they've been rated as A-graded researchers or B-grade researchers or C-graded researchers. And you'll see that in all these cases, the statistics have been changing favorably. But if you look at the table, you'll see that the percentage, for example, of black grant holders in the latest years was still only 28%, which is clearly not representative and needs significant further attention. The National Research Foundation is aware of that, and we're working very closely with them and the Department of Education and Training to improve these statistics. I have mentioned previously the Bioethical Research Head Initiative and the Center of Excellence. These are two key programs to support established researchers. So the South African Research Chairs Initiative, this is essentially research positions that are funded by the Department of Science and Technology, but that sit in the university. So we provide the salary as well as the research costs and expenses of these research professors. We've awarded 157 chairs so far, and we will be shortly awarding a further 23 chairs. So by the end of this calendar year, we should have about 180 chairs that we support directly in the universities. These are very important in supervising postgraduate students, because these are established researchers that have the capacity to supervise postgraduate students. And in 2013, they supervised a total of 1,600 students, these chairs altogether. I should mention that of the 40 of these 157 chairs are co-funded with private sector partners like banks or with international partners. So about a third of the research chairs are funded with external parties. So that's quite important. And in the Centre of Excellence program, these are physical or virtual centres of research which enable collaboration across disciplines or institutions. So these are not individual researchers. These are consortia, as it were, groups of researchers that have been brought together under a centre, which we call the Centre of Excellence. We have 14 of these established, and they also are very important in providing supervision to postgraduate students, supporting 650 postgrad students. Just some concluding comments here. If the interventions are yielding results in terms of the expansion of the supervisory capacity of the system, so we've gone from no research chairs to 150 research chairs over a period of 8 or 9 years, something like that. We've gone from no centers of excellence to 15 centers of excellence over a 10 or 12 year period. The number of researchers that are receiving grants to do research has been increasing steadily over the last 2 years as well. So we've been increasing the capacity of the system. A number of organizations are sponsoring chairs outside of the DfE and the National Research Foundation. I've already mentioned that. The initiatives are gradually succeeding in improving race and gender inequity amongst the students supervised, but not at the rate that we would want to be. And then lastly, there are additional investments in these initiatives that would be essential to expand further the capacity of the system and improve student representation. This last slide to give you an indication of the amount invested in these different programs, the Next Generation Program, Emerging Research Program, Established Research Program, and then we have the two other programs that we call Cross-Cutting Instruments and Strategic Investments. If you just total the amounts in the bottom row there, that works out to about 1.3 billion rand. So that's the amount of money that we're investing through the National Research Foundation at the moment in supporting research in universities and some of the science councils. And that includes then also the bursary support, which is just under 500 million in that slide there. Turning now to some sector-specific human capital development interventions, which was the second part of the brief that we received from the Honourable Member and the Honourable Chair. Just to make a point about the general approach to sector-specific human capital development. Remember, in my first slide, I tried to illustrate that we have different portfolio and mandates to the Department of Higher Education Training. The Department of Higher Education and Training is responsible for what happens in the universities and the further education and training bands, the training colleges, that are distributed throughout the country in all different provinces. And so the Department of Education and Training, together with the colleges and the universities, are responsible for the content of the training that happens in those institutions. This is not our responsibility. What we're responsible for is supporting research activities in specific sectors and supported students in those research activities in specific sectors. So what a college for agriculture, a TVET college for agriculture might do is really subject to the Department of Higher Education training. If that college undertakes postgraduate training and postgraduate research, we would be supporting those activities. So it's important to make that distinction, because whether you're training a postgraduate student in physics, theoretical physics, or whether you're training a postgraduate student in applied energy, the nature of the training is the same. They have to design a research project, they have to research the research project, they have to get information and data from all over the world, they have to, in most cases, undertake practical experiments. They have to report to their supervisors, they have to write a report at the end in the form of a PhD thesis. So the nature of the training that students get as postgraduate students is fairly generic. It's the content of the research that distinguishes a pure physics PhD from an applied energy PhD, or a maths energy from somebody who's doing something in genetic engineering. It's not so much in the nature of the training, in the nature of the project that they undertake. And this is an important point to remember. So because the generic human capital development interventions, therefore, that we support are applicable across all sector-specific programs. So whether we give a student bursary to somebody doing a maths doctoral degree or an applied energy or genetic engineering PhD, it's the same bursary, the same type of program that we support. So the programs, the human capital development programs that I've shown you earlier on, already supports training of students in specific sectors like advanced manufacturing or genetic engineering, biotechnology. The students are already supported through our generic human capital development programs. Secondly, many of our research chairs, the SACHI chairs that I was talking about, are in areas that have specific industrial applications, as are our centers of excellence. At this university hosts a center of excellence for hard materials. This is looking at how do you manufacture new hard materials and how do you machine hard materials like diamonds, for example. So research into hard materials, hard metals, and ceramics, and diamonds is part of the focus of this center of excellence. So I've already introduced you to these interventions that support the development and training of postgraduate students, and they're applicable in the areas I'll be talking about now as well. So that's the point that I wanted to make here, that these generic human capital development interventions are applicable in specific industrial and technological areas to persons. The second point is that the research programs that we have, or research support programs that we have in specific sectors of the economy, for materials manufacturing, for example, or for energy, or for waste management, or for water purification. We support research activities in all of these sectors. And within those sectors, they formulate specific human capital development interventions and targets. So they say, within our work that we're going to be doing in ICT, for example, we want to produce 20 PhDs in the field of ICT, using the instrument that I've just outlined to you, the bursary, the research chair, the centers of excellence. And then the third point is that all sector-specific programs seek to earmark 30% of their budget for human capital development. So 30% of the money that we might invest in IT research and development, we will try and earmark for human capital development. So we recognize the importance of HCD in all of these areas. What I'd like to do now is illustrate this approach to you by talking about three specific examples. The way that we support human capital development in R&D-led industry development, we have a program that focuses on research and development-led industry development, on ICT skills in the ICT sector, and then lastly in the green economy. So first of all, turning to the so-called R&D-led industry development program. Here, the human capital development takes place in these sectors in two different ways. The one is human capital development initiatives aligned with specific sectors that we have an interest in. Titanium, for example. South Africa is one of the world's biggest producers of titanium. that we export titanium in a completely unbeneficiated form, basically as a powder. Titanium is a unique metal. It is a very strong metal and very, very light. So it's of great industry in the aeronautics and space sector. But the trick to utilizing it in those sectors is being able to manufacture titanium metal and then machine the titanium metal to turn it into parts that you use in engines or rockets and airplanes. And so we've been investing for a long time in developing this capacity in South Africa to move from just powdered titanium into titanium blocks of metal, and then learning how to developing the technologies to machine this titanium metal into components that can be then used within these sectors. So we've been investing heavily in this, and within that program, we've been supporting a lot of human capital development initiatives as well. Another example is fluorochemicals. NESCA, Nuclear Energy Corporation of South Africa, which is based at Tilindalas, South Pretoria. They operate a factory that produces fluorine. And again, we export fluorine in a fairly basic form. But fluorine is a very important ingredient in a whole lot of important pharmaceutical processes. HIV/AIDS vaccines, for example, it forms an input into those sorts of pharmaceutical processes. So again, we're looking at improving the technological capacity in South Africa to take fluorine to the next level of beneficiation. And associated with that are student support programs and so on. And then we have one generic program, which is called the Science, Engineering and Technology Industry Internship Program, which I will be introducing to you shortly as well. So just to continue then, our human capital development program, how they align with our sector-specific R&D program. So the bottom left, this is a scheme to show you where our human capital development focus fits in conceptually in our program to develop specific sectors of the economy. So on the bottom left-hand side, when we look at things, I see there the opportunities that we identify, for example, titanium. We have a resource endowment in South Africa. We have huge resources of titanium in South Africa. So we've identified an opportunity in this regard. We have a certain level of skill and capability in South Africa that we need to develop it further. And if we can develop a local procurement market for titanium products, then we've really got a good reason for developing titanium technology. Then we look for champions. Do we have, for example, a center of competence, which is similar to center of excellence, which I've mentioned previously? Or is there an original equipment manufacturer? Is there a company that produces titanium parts, titanium tools or parts in South Africa that would have an interest in partnering with the department to develop further competence to manufacture these tools in South Africa or these parts? So is there a champion? It could be an original equipment manufacturer from the private sector, in other words, or it could be associated with a state-owned company. So it could be, in a particular area, there might be a state-owned company, fluorine, for example. In the case of fluorine, NESCA, state-owned company, has a particular interest in developing capacity and competence around fluorine chemistry in South Africa. So if we have an opportunity and we can identify champions, then we need to look at what are the enablers, what do we need in order to develop this sector? Well, we need infrastructure. We need pilot plants to produce these new pharmaceuticals from fluorine. Or we need pilot plants that can produce titanium blocks from titanium powder. So we need infrastructure. We need science, technology, and innovation. It cannot be just a science program. It must be focused on innovation and commercial development, economic development. And then we need skills. And this is really at the center of this slide, and at the center of this presentation. So this is just, and then hopefully the outcomes of this will be new products, new markets, and improved competitiveness for our local industry. So you can see that the skills input is key in the way that we conceptualize development of specific sectors. Turning now to the example that I mentioned earlier of a specific industry and social program here, this is mainly targeted at enabling University of Technology students, and I'll show you just now a geographic map of where these are located. At University of Technology, you'll be familiar with the concept. These are what used to be called the Technicons, and they then were transformed into universities of technology. In some cases, they were merged with others. Here in Cape Town, for example, there's the Cape Peninsula University of Technology, then there's Lesotho University of Technology in Durban, and the Durban University of Technology as well. So there are a number of these universities of technology, and this program focuses to a large extent on them. There are a number of different ways or a number of different implementing entities, the second column of the table, where this program is implemented, where we support interns. So if you can just look at the first one there in the second column, technology stations. These are my centers of excellence located at universities of technology. And for example, we have placed there, I think this is for 2013, 92 interns that we support in these technology stations. And I will show you just now what the technology stations do. Just to give you another example, further down in that column, MinTech, the Council for Mineral Technology, which is located in Randburg in Johannesburg, it reports to the Department of Mineral Resources. It's responsible for promoting the development of our mineral sector in South Africa. We support, for example, 53 interns that work at this research council called MinTech in areas related to minerals development. So the technology stations program, which I've just mentioned, where we support both the research activity and we place interns in the technology station programs. So on the left-hand side there, you'll see just a list of technology stations that are involved in agro-processing, in the agro-processing sector and the chemical sector. And you'll see here at the Cape Peninsula University of Technology, for example, there's a technology center, a technology station that has to do with agro-food processing. University of Limpopo, there's one dealing with agro-food processing. Tshwane University of Technology in Gauteng deals with chemistry and chemical engineering. So you'll see here a list of the universities of technology that are supported with the placement of interns. And on the right-hand side, you'll see a number of programs that have to do also at the University of Technology with the manufacturing sector. So and right at the bottom, for example, Walter Sisulu University, you'll see that we have a program there on design tooling, dyes, and mold making. At CPUT, for example, just further up on the right-hand side, and Adaptronics. I must explain my ignorance here. I don't know what Adaptronics is. But I can certainly find out for you. So there's a wide range of industrial sectors in which we're supporting research and development programs and interns. And in this slide, honorable members and honorable chair, you'll see the geographic spread of our technology stations program, TSP, that's technology station program. So this is a national footprint, and you'll see that they really are spread all over the country. They're linked to the universities of technology, and they are focused on supporting the local industrial sectors, industrial commercial sectors, around the vicinity of those technology stations. But they also have national mandates. In agriculture, doesn't just happen in small parts of the country, it happens all over. So the technology stations dealing with agricultural support, for example, have a national mandate, but they would also be located in local areas where there's a strong interest in specific sectors. So that's the national footprint. Turning to the second example that I was talking about, which is the ICT skills. The first sector was the R&D-led industrial development. Then I think I was going to introduce the honorable members of the committee to just briefly the development of skills in the ICT sector. Now remember, we're not looking at the development of certificates for ICT. People who finish school and do a year for a certificate in ICT at one of these private providers. This is not what we're looking at. We're looking at the development of high-level skills, master's and PhD-level skills in the field of ICT. So in 2007, the department approved an ICT research, development, and innovation strategy. And it has specific human capital development objectives, which I've listed here. I will leave these in the interest of time for the members of the committee to read. What's more important for me is to demonstrate to you the investments that we've made in supporting skills development, high-level skills development in ICT under this ICT strategy from 2007. And you'll see here on the left-hand side the specific ICT clusters or ICT fields, if you want. So broadband infrastructure and services, ICT for development, mobile health, sustainability and environment, these are all different fields for ICT applications. And in the columns on the right, you'll see the number of masters and PhD students that have been supported during the five-year period from 2007 to 2013 in these different fields. And you see a total of 265 masters and PhD students have been supported. Now, some of them are still currently registered, but they might have only registered in 2013 for the first time under this program. So they may not yet have finished their degrees. But many of those 265 will already have finished their degrees and will now be working either in the research sector or in the ICT sector. So again, this has been a significant investment. We have now just very recently approved an updated ICT strategy because the old one was now several or 8 years old. We have up to there been a lot of development in ICT globally and nationally, so we've needed to revise that ICT strategy from 2007, and we've developed what we've now called the ICT Research, Development and Innovation Roadmap, which is a five-year plan aligned with the MTSF and the strategic plan of the department, as well as the first five-year period of the National Development Plan. And the ambition for this roadmap or to take national ICT RDI strategy to the next level in a way that strengthens the local ICT ecosystem, I've mentioned that already, to enable the DSC to develop and implement a set of specific interventions required to guide and direct ICT research, development and innovation activities in South Africa, and to position South Africa more competitively in the global market, taking cognizance of and addressing the challenges facing developing economies. In the CIPAR, the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, we have a unit there called the Maraca Institute, and they really are our agents for managing our ICT roadmap. Now, the important thing from the point of view of your interest in this presentation is the ambitions, the targets that this roadmap, this ICT roadmap, has set. So, over the four-year period to 2024, these are the ambitions that have been set for producing master's, PhD, and postdoc students in these various fields of ICT. Now, of course, because this is a new plan, I can't tell you how we'll deliver on these plans. But I can assure you that we make plans, and we're serious about them. We develop programs to support them. We align our financial resources to support the plans and the objectives that we make. And these sorts of objectives then find expression in our annual performance plan and the targets in our annual performance plan and in our strategic plan for the department for the five-year period moving ahead. Then the last example that I said I was going to introduce to the committee has to do with the green economy research and development. You will know, honourable members, that the concept of the green economy, it can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. But it is clear that the concept of the green economy is becoming an important conceptual framework for the transformation of our economy. Everybody will agree that as we transform our economy, we have to do it in a more sustainable way. We cannot be developing our economy in a way that uses up all our resources over a short period of time. We have to think about the sustainable development of our economy, both at national level as well as at regional and local level. And the green economy is really the concept that begins to drive this notion of a stable development and transformation of our economy. So the department has a number of programs within the concept of the green economy, the framework of the green economy. And there are three here that I'd like to briefly mention and describe to you our human capital development interventions in those three programs. So we have a research, development and innovation roadmap for the waste sector. You know, we think of waste as waste. Well, we've done a very detailed analysis of South Africa's waste sector and have identified that I think the amount is 20 billion rand worth of value that can be unlocked. Does somebody corroborate that? I think it's an enormous amount of money. And it's not something that, you know, people have just tucked out of their thumbs. There's been a really serious investigation. I speak under Christian and maybe less than that, but it's significant amount of value. And already at the marginal end of society, people are already living off the waste sector. But there are industrial level undertakings that are based on the waste sector as well. So the waste sector has huge potential, and of course it's integral to the notion of a sustainable economy. So we've developed a roadmap, a research development and innovation roadmap that seeks to develop our capacity to turn the waste sector into a commercial opportunity, an economic opportunity. The water sector, of course, is absolutely critical, and we need to do more research in this to turn also the water sector into a development opportunity and an economic opportunity. And then lastly, the area of environmental services. We have some programs there as well. So first of all, just looking at the human capital development commitments that our plans, research programs in the waste and water sectors and the environmental sector, for example, the environmental services sector, have committed to. So for the next financial year, 35 honours, masters and doctoral students will be fully funded or co-funded in designated niche areas that support the green economy and sustainable development. Specifically, 15 will be supported in the environmental services sector and 20 in the waste and water roadmaps. Using the instruments that I was talking about earlier on, bursaries and research support for their supervisors. So we'll be using those instruments, but specifically targeting students who are working in these sectors so that we can develop these sectors and the students' capacity to develop businesses and economic opportunities in those sectors. The 10-year target overall is to produce 244 masters, 163 PhDs, and 65 postdocs in these three sectors here. I think that's just for the environmental services. The last bullet, 10-year HCD commitment for the waste and the water road out there. You'll see again significant numbers of students that we are planning to train in these sectors. And remember, it's the training in those sectors in part that helps to develop these sectors, whether it's titanium or waste or water. I would like to spend just 5 minutes quickly talking about our self promotion and engagement activities. We've spoken so far about what we're doing at the high-end skills, postgraduate student training. It is, of course, an input into the university system that comes from the schools. And although we do not have any authority over 76,000 schools or 12 million school learners, we nonetheless have a responsibility to promote a broader understanding of and appreciation of science and technology, the importance of science and technology in our lives, the fact that science and technology offers career opportunities, particularly in communities where these might not well be appreciated because these communities do not have a lot of scientists and senior academics. And so the gap between their understanding of the role that science plays from a career development perspective and what the community's experiences of career development, there are gaps and we need to address this. So we have a range of activities in the area of general popularization of science and communication of science that focus on this challenge. So in 2014, we adopted a framework for DFT activities in support of basic education. We are not responsible for basic education, but we recognize the need to support basic education, specifically around science, technology, mathematics, things like that. So this framework supports basic education by promoting public engagement with science, and I'll give you examples of how we do that, specific interventions that we undertake, and enhancing effective teaching and learning environments through technology and educational research. So the Human Sciences Research Council, for example, which is one of our entities, they have a large program looking at education how to improve education and how to improve educational technology. So just through the research that we undertake through our entity, we are making a contribution. We also have a number of South African research chairs, the senior professors that we fund, who work in education, educational research, pedagogic research. So through the research that we undertake, we support basic education. And then we have public engagement activities, which I'll give you examples of just now. Then the science engagement program comprises an established portfolio of activities, which in many ways complement the objectives of the national strategy for mathematics, science and technology education, and generally contribute to teaching and learning of mathematics and science. So what are examples of this? So for example, we run annually a National Science Week. I'm not sure if the Honourable Members have heard of this. This is an initiative that circulates through each province on an annual basis. Last year it was in Tuesday. This year, I don't know where it is this year. I forget, I'm sorry. But this year it's been another province. So it circulates through each province. However, although the launch of the National Science Week always takes place in a particular province, our National Science Week activities are spread throughout the country. And we have local partners in all the provinces. These are NGOs, they may be universities, sometimes they are companies, sometimes they're community-based organizations, sometimes they're science centers. So all of the provinces, there are partners that support us in ensuring that the National Science Week really is a national event. So activities like the National Science Week, for example, and science festivals, and science-centered science awareness exhibits stimulates learners' interest in mathematics and science, and these enhance, of course, the Department of Basic Education's attention to increase learner participation in these learning areas. So through these outreach activities, we hope to stimulate greater interest among schooling kids in science and technology. About 700,000 participants in the National Science Week and various festivals, science festivals that we run, are learners. So that 700,000 is only a small portion of 12 million, but it's still 700,000 kids that get exposed to science and technology activities which they might not otherwise be exposed to if we didn't run these sorts of programs. And then up to some 65% of the 1.5 million visitors to science centers were learners. So we support also a large number of science centers around the country.
Chair, with your permission, may I have this sheet out? This is a list of science centers that the department supports in all of the provinces.
This has also the details of the contact persons for the different science centers. And we support more than 30 science centers around the country, spread all across the provinces. And as I said, these science centers are sometimes linked to universities, sometimes they are linked to community-based organizations, sometimes they're linked to companies. So in, I think, Limpopo, some mining companies support science centers in-house, and we partner with them. So these science centers that we support around the country, in addition to having pure science awareness exhibits, science centers also have hands-on exhibits that are linked to curriculum concepts across the grades. Here are some important and useful statistics. Of the 32 science centers that we support, 27% have fully equipped science laboratories. Of course, we want all of them to have fully equipped science laboratories, but we're building this up systematically over the years. So 27% have the fully equipped science laboratories. 42%, almost half, have mobile laboratories. These are basically buses or buggies that have got science laboratories equipped within them. They're like a camper van, but it's a science laboratory. 12% of those science centers collaborate with their provincial departments of education in the delivery of teaching service training in the 2015 academic year. I can mention, for example, there's a science center linked to the University of Zululand, based in Richards Bay, really in a fairly rural environment. They support 45,000 school kids from that rural area on an annual basis in getting access to science equipment that those rural-based schools don't have. And there's a partnership between the KwaZulu-Natal Department of Education and the Science Center, where the provincial Department of Education provides the bus support, the bus of the students, the school kids, to the Science Center a few times a year to go and work with the experiments in the Science Center. I'm not sure if that program is still running. The last time I went and visited them a couple of years ago, it was still running. I think it still is. So this is an example. There's Capital Science Center that has a similar relationship. There's one in Gauteng and Joburg that also has a similar relationship with the Provincial Department of Education. So these science centers play a very important role way beyond just the particular capacity of the department to support them. And 90% of these annually conduct supplementary tuition and or exam preparation sessions in mathematics and physical science. So this is very important in providing additional tutoring to matriculants, for example, in science and technology and mathematics. Then we also run STEMI, stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, Mathematics, and Innovation. So it's just about everything we can think of. Anyway, we run a series of Olympiads. Some of them are mathematics Olympiads. You may have heard of math Olympiads, but we also are involved in science Olympiads. So to say that we run them is not completely true. We have partners who run them, and we provide support to those partners. And these Olympiads and related competitions create an opportunity for learning, supply and refine knowledge gained from formal classroom learning and teaching. And some of these are national competitions. ESCOM, for example, runs an Olympiad, a science technology Olympiad or competition every year, from which the winners go to some global competition that they participate in. We have also used a big national mathematics Olympiad, from which the winners also go to some big global competition. We support eight Olympiads and related competitions which collectively contribute to 28% of the just about 1 million people who participate in DSE supported science engagement programs, and I'll give you more statistics on this very shortly. And then in terms of career awareness, we produce annually a booklet which describes what sorts of careers there are in science, engineering and technology. We produce about 10,000 copies of these booklets and are distributed to science centers and to some universities and through the festivals that we support and the Olympiads that we support. So obviously, if we could produce 12 million of these booklets for 12 million learners, that would be great. But that's the scale of activity that's not currently within our remit. And then this will give you just an idea for 2013 of the numbers of learners and general members of the public, in other words, people who are not learners, who participate in the National Science Week on the left-hand side. So almost 250,000 learners participate in the National Science Week, and 313,000 members of the general public participate in the National Science Week and get reached through the activities involved in that. The Olympiads, of course, are only for school learners. And you can see there are 316,000 learners that participate in the various Olympiads that we support. And in the festivals, for example, this Friday, the Science Festival in Grahamstown, like the annual Arts Festival in Grahamstown, and I launched the National Science Festival, which has been going also for 10 years. It's being launched this Friday in Grahamstown. And this is one example of festivals. And then you'll see also 150,000 students or scholars participating in such festivals. This is the level of investment over the last 5 years. You can see that there's been a healthy increase in this as well. It's not a little, but we've increased significantly the level of our investment in science and technology in popularization activities. This is the last slide, Honourable Chair. I've managed within comfortably the time that you set me, Alex. It's just the time that you set me. Just some concluding comments. So first of all, I demonstrated some statistics to show that the system is growing. We're having more researchers that we're supporting. I didn't present you statistics, but the research output, the numbers of scientific papers produced by South Africa, has doubled in the last 10 years. So a whole lot of statistics are showing that our system is growing, and we're beginning to transform it in terms of human capital. However, we certainly will need to invest more money in the postgraduate student category, postgraduate student support, coupled to tighter monitoring of the demographics and completion rates. So we can't afford to have a situation where significant numbers of our students enroll for their studies and never manage to complete them. We have just undertaken a study where we've seen the first results now, detailed study to look at what are the reasons why our students do not complete their postgraduate degrees. That study will be very important in helping us to formulate interventions that will turn the situation around. We do know that finance is a very important ingredient, but it's not the only ingredient. There are other things in universities that don't really support the student in the way the students feel they need to be supported. So this study will be important in ensuring that we focus more on the question of demographics and completion rates within the system. Secondly, once our PhD graduates, we know that there's no unemployment problem with PhDs. We've got studies that show that there isn't an unemployment problem with PhD graduates. But what we don't know is where exactly do they end up working. So it's difficult for us to get a sense of what will be their impact on the country's economy, and where will that impact be felt. And this is of course relevant because we're training a lot of people for ICT and they end up in the banking sector. We need to ask ourselves the question, is this what we want to achieve? It may be. Because maybe that's why we're training people in ICT, so they can go into actuarial services and the banking sector and the insurance sector. But maybe we also need ICT people moving into other sectors, and then we want to tweak our programs to make sure we create better opportunities there. So we need to get a better sense of where our students go, and we're developing a system to track PhD graduates. I spoke about the silent majority problem, the fact that with 12,000 permanent academics, of whom only roughly 650 come to us for research grants, we need to understand what are the structural and institutional problems in the universities around us to turn more of these academics into research exercise. Some of them will never become. They're over 50 and they've only been teaching for most of their academic life. They'll never maybe become. It's just not an option anymore. But amongst those 12,000, there must be many who want to become involved and can't. We need to understand those reasons. More resources are required to grow the established researcher initiatives, which is the point I've just made, and continue to increase established researchers. Because even if we grow the number of PhD students, if we don't have enough established researchers to supervise them, we can't supervise the students. So there's a limit to growth in the number of PhDs that is set by the number of established researchers. So we need to move more emerging researchers to become established researchers. And then the last and highest level point is that the National Development Plan targets are ambitious. We think that they could be achievable if we significantly ramp up the level of investment in postgraduate training and research support. We do think that those targets are important. They are informed by global comparison. If we compare ourselves to other emerging economies and to developed countries, those indicators are the right indicators. The benchmarks that have been set in the National Development Plan are important for us. So we really should try and achieve them. And we think we can perhaps manage that, but only if we significantly wrap up the level of investment. Honourable Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm going to allow members to post questions before I'm going to see it. If you ask one, I think you will start with this one, the last I wanted to understand if money is the only thing in a low number of people. In the university, research and study is going to love the department.
Because the only thing that we have to do is
and also his comments, because he won't have an opportunity to get there of having the letter of invitation and in the SLP. So the first question for you was to find out what all these numbers that you have to really have of the research from all the section of the letters. Do you have any picture of the people that need to come with the dream or the training that they have received from us, and how does that obviously improve the efforts that are being made to retain And also, I was interested in slide number 4 in the acknowledgement of the importance of posting climate exposition, although I believe that you are taking care of the slide later. When you were outlining what is being done, but I would like to think that you need to know how is it going, how has it come to the increase of this number of And then I also wanted to confirm that the numbers that we're talking about, these like 7, where we say number 8, north, number 12, and then those are actually just in the science of technology.
No,
there's two other projects.
No, it's all fields.
Yes, wow.
You were in social sciences, law, fine arts, everything.
Okay. Okay. And then the other thing that I wanted to find out, because this is what the minister said yesterday. He said the education that we have is purely academic, and it doesn't do anything to prepare students already doing other things. They are starting with in this very linear sort of academic thing. And I'm saying, how then can it be done as early as the, and I think we also touched on this in the stage, the presentation, how then can it be done that, because one comes from a very, very rural, in fact, you should say that you're talking about, I can't remember today, where you don't know anything about what you're going to do in the future until you are in college. And then your choice, your cost is not prepared for what you might like to say. So I was just thinking how, with what the minister is saying and maybe the efforts that the department is making, how can that be incorporated, what you just said now, to create the interest within the government itself, say, the interest in these things can be started at a very early age, so that the choice is even broader for individuals to get both up the education for another. But also, one is also very mindful of the fact that you cannot wait as a student who has responsibility, financial responsibility to bring up your brothers and your sisters and your nieces and everybody to get rid of school so you can find a job. So what can be done to make this whole process attractive for us to grow in this sector also? And then the other question, I was quite excited. About the 400 million that you mentioned, and just wanted to know what you've done, whether there is a presentation made generally to put all the point of the decision of this because it's quite an amazing, encouraging amount of money that they have in this sector. And my question also wanted to find out throughout this. What is the partnership with the private sector being? Like in trying to invest or whatever, the partnership with NRF is providing the business. And the slide 17 talks about emerging researchers, the average grant revenue. Those number of grants, are they the available grants, or are those what has been sought by the research? I
would
say out of 1,000,
we only had 682.
Or
it's that, yes. About 650 grants were awarded.
Yes.
I don't know the exact number of people who would have applied, but perhaps 1,000 or so would have applied.
Yes.
And of those 1,000, 650 were successful.
Okay. And the attrition of black women into this. I mean, I think you also mentioned later in the presentation and testing the specific things that you're talking to. The research that needs to be done, because this jumping, that the queue from 780,000 to such a small number, what happened? Even our speculation is that the person needs to go and work, and then they actually said, oh, to go and look for 100,000 and to pay for that grant that you talk about. Why would be interested in some kind of a study that tells us to show what's going on here? Some question with an answer or perhaps. The infrastructure. In slide 27 of the R&D list, we had oversight visit here to the state for me and I said our and throughout we went to OBC, we went to the Council for Social Science, we went to all of them without it, especially for them. They worried about the and the how the infrastructure links to all the other things that the NDC does not do. The infrastructure cannot, the architect, the scientists, that what they want to attract because they go elsewhere, they spend that infrastructure and they can be able to learn and describe what they are interested in. So is this now the infrastructure thing, is it something that the government is looking at to say we can improve it so that we can attract more people that will pay, because if it affected, when we were asking questions, it affected the attraction, the retention, and the general interest of the scientists that we will get to stay with them, who are interested in what they're doing, but they can't stay because of the infrastructure challenges that they are facing. And the last question, which is part of it. I would like to know the interim sort of cohort that is part of the SKA. That's the right question to ask. Yes, because one is very excited, so you can see me and focus on older young people who are going to come out there to be very excited. And so I wanted to come back to this.
Thank you, Paul Shepherdson. BTV, I have actually made contact with one of my friends, which is Canary Paul, his name is Google, on Adaptonic. Struggling to pronounce it. Innovative new cross-sectional technology for the optimization of structured systems. So it's adapted structure technology. So just sort of for interface. I basically want to make a statement and a suggestion and we've done it previously. I don't know if you were present at that specific meeting that we had. Specifically on basic education when it comes to secondary school, because I think that's where the problem lies, why we struggle to get essentially our black students to get into the system, because you have to go and check your supply side of it, By the time that it gets to university level, you know, it's already, it's part of that. So you have to nurture that. And I want to support what Honorable Mutambo also said. I think what we need to do, because rural villages, their school, I've visited a lot from overseas, and they don't have science and technology laboratories or, you know, any equipment to do that. So it's not even an option for those students to go into that direction. And I think there we might have a big potential, but it's not stimulated, it's not nurtured. And I think a solution, because obviously it's going to cost this government a lot of money to have labs at all those places. But if we can maybe through the Department of Science and Technology, as you get more and more involved with basic education, you know, to help stimulate that we maybe get mobile labs and maybe teams that move around and have interaction with those rural schools, specifically in the rural communities, because that's where the big need is. And I think through that, we will really start changing this pattern of having only the previously advantaged communities really going into that specific direction. Thank you.
Thank you, one last question. How can you take patent position if it is a part of the science trust for England to study for
thank you. I'm sorry I took you on the thank you, Honorable Chair and the members, for your a great message to support our presentation and the content of it. Obviously, I'd like to point out that it's really the entire department that contributes to the achievement. I just happen to be lucky enough to be representing the department here today. So thank you to all of the colleagues also from my side who participated in this. I think in responding to the comments and the questions that have been asked, I will make some general observations because I think they will cover many of the comments that you made. So, for example, the question about how do we improve the rate at which students enroll for postgraduate degrees, and in particular, black students and women. This is a question that the chair asked, this is a question that Honorable Mafango also asked. You specifically also referred to black women. You made other questions, had other more general concerns. So, let me just talk a little bit more about the study that we've undertaken, and allow me to just digress for a second to make an analogy to something that I always find very useful. We all know that climate change is something that's happening to us right now. We all know that climate change has to do with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than was a few hundred years ago, and we all know that this carbon dioxide is largely man-made. That's human origin. There's some people who deny that, but anyway, there's this volume of opinion that agrees on this. But we also all know that the problem is complex, that it's not just one source. And if we could only do something about that one source, it would eliminate the problem. So we all know that if we all stop flying, it wouldn't stop the problem of CO2 production. It would reduce it by 5 or 6%. If we all stop driving cars, it would reduce the problem by 8 or 10% or 9%, whatever, and wouldn't stop the problem. So the solution to that problem is characterized by a number of different factors that all play fairly small amounts, a fairly small role in themselves, but together they give a big problem. And my experience is that this is characteristic of life. It's seldom when we're faced with problems in our lives is there one single thing we can do to eradicate the problem. It's usually that we have to do a number of different things all at the same time, and all equally difficult. Well, this is the same challenge with regard to how do we change the demographics and how do we get more students to enroll in postgraduate. The study that we've undertaken was intended to give us better answers to this question. What exactly
are factors that determine whether students enroll for degrees or not. And science is a very important one. And it is racially linked, that finance plays a stronger role amongst black students, undergraduate students, than amongst white undergraduate students. But finance is not the only thing that determines among either whites or blacks whether they decide to do postgraduate. There are other things that are involved in it. There are factors that have to do with their own background, like you were talking about, your history does not help you to determine what it is that you are going to be doing once you are chosen. So this study has revealed that those things play a role as well. They're not the major thing, but they play a role. The other thing that plays a role is the reputation of the university in that field of research. The students factor this in, like consumers, they factor this in to making a decision, I want to do a postgraduate degree and I want to do it at this university that has this reputation. Their relationship with their teaching staff is another very important factor that comes out of the study. So the answer to both of your questions is that it's a complex issue. There are a number of different things that have to be addressed. Within our competence, the thing we can address is the extent of support for the students, the financial opportunities for students to support themselves and their extended families, as the Honourable Makanga also referred to, the expectation of supporting brothers and sisters. You're now at the university, we've all spent money, you've gotten your degree, now you need to help us. So the financial opportunity is for students to be able to service these obligations is a very important driver in determining it. The other thing is then the quality of the research that's undertaken at that institution. And again, that's something that we have an impact on because we provide the research grant and we determine whether that university should be supported from a research development point of view. So to a large extent, managing these interventions addresses the challenges that we've got, but it's not one single thing that we can do. We presented, however, to Treasury, and this is a specific question that was asked by the Honourable Mahango, what did we do to persuade Treasury to put these forward in? First of all, I think not just us. I think that government as a whole has realised the essential importance of education, of skills development, to unemployment, to poverty, to economic transformation. And there's a dream across the political spectrum in this regard. So in our case, this translates into support for postgraduate students. In other government departments, it translates in other ways. But in our case, it's support in this way. So Treasury, I'm sure, has understood the need to support postgraduate student development as part of our educational imperative to change the our economy and our lives. We have also been able to show them the statistics that we're only supporting 7% of all the postgraduates. We don't need to do much studies to be able to figure out that the pool of students who would like to have support is going to be much bigger than 7%. You don't need to do any studies like that. We also showed them what the average levels are that we support that the students at the honors, masters, and PhD level. And again, you don't need to do much research to know that if you've got a bachelor's degree, you could probably earn off the tap around 100,000 rand a year. Whereas the bursary you're giving is 40,000. So it's very simple for Treasury to be persuaded that both the per capita amount and the number of bursaries that we can and should be awarding can be increased. And their concern always is, of course, can they absorb the money? And we can easily double the number of students who get bursaries and double the amount of money they each get. So we can easily quadruple the amount of money we invest in postgraduate students overnight, and none of the money will waste it. It will all go to that purpose. Treasury, I think, has responded to the high-level priority and to our presentation of the particular case for the Department of Science and Technology. Your last question, Honourable Chair, we will have to get back to you on that. I hope some of my colleagues have made a note of the specific detailed question I can't answer right now. On the question of the number of patents that have been lodged.
Oh, you've got something.
Okay, we'll get back to that just now. Let me just deal with some of the other comments and questions. The question of HU fairs, the support that we provide at basic education levels, Honourable Fungal raised as well, Honourable Smith also addressed this issue. The career booklets that we provide, I don't know for a fact that they feature in the edu fairs that the Honourable thing referred to, but I would be very surprised if they don't, because we provide these career booklets to schools, and the whole intention is that they should be using them for these sorts of engagements that they have with the pupils
to provide career guidance to them. We also provide them to science centers and partner with schools in helping students with career choices and career advice. So, as I said, I don't know for a fact, but I'm assuming that our books will surface in some of those issue fairs. And that is the exact purpose for which we produce these booklets, is to help students with these sorts of choices. But of course, it's not just the booklet. It's the whole range of things. It's the parents, on the one that was referring. It's the environment from which you come that helps guide you. I have two sons who are in TIC right now. One of them seems to know what he wants to do. The other one is not clear, and it's not as if they haven't had the benefit and me and the privilege of my levels of education. So it's a complex question, as young people answer in a number of different ways, drawing on all kinds of peers, parents, brothers, sisters, teachers, and those things might also be counterintuitive. You know, they might not like what each other are telling them. So, but we do try to support it in a sense here. There were two questions from the Honourable Singh and the Honourable Masango who were concerned about the risk associated or the loss associated with us training people in South Africa and then them going abroad and taking their skills abroad. Of course, that's a reasonable concern to have. Let me respond to it in two ways. The first is to say science is a global enterprise, and South African scientists can only become better scientists if they go abroad, because they get exposed to research infrastructures and environments and activities that we can't offer them here. And they can bring that knowledge, those networks, that experience back to South Africa. So the question is, what are we doing in the country? Not only to keep them here, but to bring people here. Whether they're South Africa, they've gone abroad, and then they come back because they see better opportunities here. Or whether they're foreigners who come to South Africa. So the key question is, what are we doing to bring people to South Africa? And it's important also sometimes people who've done a PhD, it's important for them to go abroad and expand their horizon and then come back and utilize the opportunities that we're doing here. So in this respect, there are a number of interventions that we're making. These kinds of research chairs initiative was specifically designed to bring scientific skills from outside the country into the country, whether they're former South Africans or ex-South Africans or foreigners that matter, but to bring them in. So it's designed to create an attractive environment to do research and science in South Africa. Action programs like the SKA, the Square Kilometre Array project, the NICAP project, the biggest telescope that we're building, it's a global flagship project. We have recently undertaken a study of astronomy in South Africa, and we've seen a huge upswing in the number of students involved, and the numbers of papers produced by South African astronomers, and the number of foreign astronomers who come to South Africa to do astronomy here. So having flagship projects and infrastructure is another very important part of it. We have another example, which is not in our department, but the SA Agalis, you know, the Department of Environment Affairs owns a boat called the SA Agalis 2. The R1.5 billion research laboratory for marine and aquatic research. It's a huge infrastructure that can be utilized to draw people here who want to do research in these sorts of environments. So having flagship projects and key programs that are globally interesting and competitive is a way of bringing people here. The last piece of information to leave you with this is we have ways of measuring in science the extent to which the scientific output that we produce in South Africa, we use the scientific output produced in South Africa to measure whether we're a net exporter of scientific skills or a net importer. There's particular methodologies that we can use to do this, and we have reached in the last few years a state where we are importing as much intellectual capital as we are exporting. So we're at a steady state. And that's a pretty healthy position to be in. So in terms of measurements we've done, we are not a net exporter of intellectual capital. So the number of South Africans who are publishing abroad is no bigger than the number of foreigners who are publishing papers in South Africa. And that's a development in the last few years. So we think that we're in a fairly healthy state, but of course we want to attract more people here. At least we don't seem to be losing brains. There's no brain drain going on at the moment in a net thing. So Honourable Masango, I can't tell you exactly how many people in the country in any one year. It's also the 500 is fine, but what what we're comfortable with is that from an intellectual capital point of view, we're gaining at least as much as we may be losing. And even when people do leave, they may very well be leaving as part of their training. It's common for PhD graduates to go abroad to do postdoctoral training for 2 or 3 years and then come back to the country. It's very common. So that was the one question. I've spoken a bit about our work in popularization of science technology at the school level. The mobile laboratories, I did refer to, we do support mobile laboratories. But our work at basic education level really more intended to demonstrate to schools and to provincial education departments new technologies and new approaches that can improve the educational experience of the learners and the teachers. So the mobile laboratories that we've established, for example, can demonstrate to partners in the provincial education department that this is a method which those departments might want to adopt and roll out. We can assist them with that, but we don't have the capacity or the human resources to run programs like that. For example, in Kofibaba, we will be establishing a new science center as a demonstrator, as a pilot, to show what you can do by establishing a science center in a largely rural environment. But we can't do this everywhere in the country. It's beyond our mandate and capacity. So many of the initiatives that I gave you examples of, we do them in order to demonstrate our intervention. We also have technology, educational technology demonstrator projects, which I didn't even start to talk about. So that's the context for the work that we're doing in this area. And we certainly would want to assist relevant partners, departments for government, governments or other entities in scaling up the sort of work that we've done and providing them with the support in this regard. There was another key education question which you were asking, which is about the work preparedness of university graduates. As I indicated earlier, that's really something that the universities and the colleges and the Department of Higher Education and Training are also grappling with. And I think what's been recognized within that sector and by the Human Resources Development Council, which is chaired by the Deputy President, which looks at these kind of questions exactly, is the need to create a better integration with the private sector with the public sector. In some European countries, for example, they have extremely close partnerships in the Germanic countries, in Germany and Switzerland, for example, they have very close contacts between private sector and the TVET colleges, the vocational and educational training colleges, where students spend a portion of their time in the academic institution being trained in an academic theoretical way, and then as part of their training, they go and spend 6 months in the private sector. The technicons, the former technicons, had such programs, and they had structure that managed this. And to some extent, that has been lost through a rearrangement in the higher education sector. But I know that Minister Zeman has recently become very aware of this and is very determined to re-establish this integration. And we are doing that in our sphere by supporting partnerships, research partnerships between the private sector and public research institutions and universities. We support a number of research programs that specifically focus on those partnerships, and students get trained in those partnerships. So in our area, we think that we are facilitating the preparation of preparing students for such careers. But significant numbers of PhD graduates, of course, are being prepared for universities and for science councils and not for industry. So we need to be identified in one too. The private sector partnerships, I've already mentioned that in the research chairs, 40 out of 150 posts are supported by the private sector or foreign partners. All of our centers of excellence, like the 14 centers of excellence, all of them have to produce third stream income. They are required by CF. Support indicators for them, in terms of which they're all required to generate a certain amount of their budget from third stream income. Usually this is a private sector, but it might also be international sponsors. So the idea of building partnerships with the private sector, both from a knowledge point of view and from a resource point of view, this is integrated into most of our programs. The science centers that we run, for example, I mentioned earlier on, there's a, I forget now which mining companies, probably it's not to mention it anyway, if I could remember it now. There are a number of mining companies
that support science research in the country. Some don't, but many do. Some of them even support them in-house, within their own buildings. So in response to community needs that have been expressed within those communities, we partner with them. So the private sector really does support our activities in this portfolio that I present to you in a number of different areas. But that's not to say that as a department at a high level, we want to try and build closer partnerships with the private sector. We have to. We know that in South Africa, the extent of the private sector investment in research and development is not what it should be and what we would want it to be. And we're developing an understanding of why this is and how we can turn that around. But that's subject for another presentation on the role of the media. Question of infrastructure. I was speaking about flagship projects, flagship infrastructure, so the FKA telescope. These are examples. Government has recognized, like education, the need to invest in infrastructure. We're talking about research and development infrastructure, but we are supported by the presidency in this. The SKA project, for example, is one of the SIP projects, Strategic Infrastructure Project number 16. Broadband connectivity is another one of those strategic projects, and there the CSIR is a very important partner in that, in the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee. So we are quite closely connected to major national infrastructure developments, and in our particular area, I can say that we have been able to grow our infrastructure investment, like we've been able to grow our human capital development investment. We've been able to grow our infrastructure development investment with Treasury support. The Treasury has really been very supportive of the Department of Science and Technology in this respect. I think I didn't answer every specific question very specifically, but the comments I may have made, I think have raised every one of the questions that I could see here, Chair, but I'm very happy to be corrected if I'm wrong. There was something that the patent thing that we will come back on to you, and I'll just make sure that you've got a question. And do you have to put up something about
I wanted to say, Chair, if you ask for the number of petitions filed by South Africans, we've got data from our National Intellectual Property Management Office. It shows data until 2011, but as you know, South African researchers who file the patent, you know, rely on the U.S. patent office, or European patent office, or even with the high additional offices. So it will depend on where are the applications left. So we've got data up to 2015, except for, you know, PCT, I mean, except for two destination points. So, but we'll complete the data as well. Maybe just to add one more thing as PDG. In terms of the industry partnership, the PDG has already mentioned the amount of funds that we leverage from the private sector in relation to the research initiative and the centers of excellence. Just to give you an indication, actually, in the current year, the year that's coming to an end, we actually transferred $451 million to the National Research Foundation. And the research are able to leverage as much, you know, that part of funding. You know, but also one other flagship initiative in that space is the electric program that the NRF implements together with the Department of Trade and Industry, where, you know, researchers from universities collaborate with industry-based researchers on problems that affect industries directly. So the industries identify the next project, and then they use the resources in terms of the research and the students that are at university. And there is a core funding there where the industry partners to us and government, that is GFPNRS, CCI, to one part. And that project is about the $23 million project.
Thank you for the question. I really want to thank
Thank you very much, Chair, for your hospitality. Thank you for your gracious questions and support as well, honourable members. We're grateful to it. We're at your disposal. Any other presentations, like your colleague was indicating, FAA, we're at your disposal to let us know what you'd like to be briefed on. And in terms of supporting members of the House to visit projects, we're also at your disposal. The front here will act as a conduit for any such requests and will help facilitate it. So thank you for your attendance and the opportunity to present it to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Most of them are
I'm not just generating them.
And then I said,
it's good stuff.